Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Whatever happened to the Americans who fought with the British in the American Revolution? Our history books are filled with stories of the brave patriots who battled for independence, but tend to neglect the tens of thousands of their neighbors who sided with Mother England instead. Maya Jasanoff is associate professor of history at Harvard University. Her new book looks at those who remained loyal to the crown, where they went, and how they shaped other parts of the world after the war. It's called Liberty's Exiles, American Loyalists in the Revolutionary War. Maya, welcome to Think.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So in many ways, the Revolutionary War was really America's first civil war. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's commonly estimated that at the outset of the Revolutionary War, something like a third of Americans remained loyal to Britain, and about a third were on the fence. So we're looking at actually a minority of Americans who sided with the Patriots. And by the end of the war, perhaps as many as a fifth of Americans continued to be loyal. So the numbers involved here on the other side of the Revolution are actually much greater than we tend to think. And what's more, these divisions in opinions often would come through families, come through communities, come through congregations and more. So you really had a situation in which neighbors would be pitted against neighbors, friends against friends, and sometimes family members against each other as well.
And perhaps to an even greater extent than in the American Civil War, these people shared a culture.
Yeah, they really did. I mean, like I say, these are people who are living alongside one another. You know, until 1776 with the Declaration of Independence, very few people in the 13 colonies really even ever imagined a future that would be different from belonging to the British Empire. By the definitions that we use today, pretty much all of the members of the First Continental Congress would count as loyalists. They all felt that the future for America was as part of the British Empire, and what they sought was some sort of way to reform that. So they all very much belonged to the same sort of culture with one another and also shared many things with their peers in Britain itself.
And when the fighting broke out, as you alluded to, you had not only neighbors on opposing sides, but sometimes members of the same family, including very prominent patriot families.
Yeah, the best-known example of this kind of division is Benjamin Franklin and his own son, William Franklin. William was Benjamin's only son, and the two of them were very, very close through the years leading up to the war. William became the governor of New Jersey. But when the tensions really began to escalate between the colonies and Britain, Benjamin and William found themselves on different sides of this question, and it fueled a really powerful rift between them, so much so that they barely spoke again after the war, and Benjamin, in fact, largely wrote William out of his will entirely. So this was a very profound kind of line of division among people, and it affected even some of the most famous figures in our revolutionary pantheon.
Reading this book made me realize how much my perception of this conflict has been colored by American patriotism. And, you know, we were all raised on thinking of how bad the British were at the time, what bad colonial managers, King George was taxing us. Can you talk about some of the reasons that loyalists, in fact, thought the crown wasn't such a bad way to go?
This idea that, you know, the king taxed us and this was terrible is certainly a somewhat retrospective vision of things. In fact, you know, at the time, the king was seen, among other things, as a protector of certain kinds of interests. And this was especially important for minority communities within the future United States. So, for example, if you were a Native American living on the frontiers of white settlements in the colonies, you tended to believe that the king was actually the best guardian of your interests because he was the person who sort of kept an eye out for how land was arranged and tried to make sure that you wouldn't be overly encroached on. Similarly, if you were a black slave in the colonies, of course you were held in slavery by an empire that very much supported slavery at that time. But when the war began, British commanders began to offer patriot-owned slaves freedom in exchange for joining the British side. And so for them, too, there was really this sense that the king was the protector of their interests, and indeed in this instance, gave them freedom. So I think we need to remember that there were many sorts of reasons to do with security, protection, and more that led people to think that the king was the best guardian of their interests.
How did the taxes paid by American colonists compare with those paid by British subjects living at home?
You know, in fact, it's a great myth about the American Revolution that we tend to think that our forebears here were taxed very, very heavily. In fact, they paid, on average, I think they paid less in taxes than many colonial Britons. And in fact, many of the taxes that were imposed on the colonies in the run-up to the war were at most sort of extensions of measures that had already been in place in Britain. The Stamp Act, for instance, which is the most notorious of the early taxes imposed on the colonies, just extended to the colonists a duty on paper products and so on that British people had been paying themselves for a long time. Another good example of how our memory tends to rewrite history a little bit is that the tax on tea, which provoked the famous Boston Tea Party, actually ended up lowering the price of tea in the colonies. And so, in fact, these taxes were perhaps not as tyrannical as the history books may imply.
Maya, when the fighting began, did people have any choice but to choose sides? Was it possible to remain neutral during the Revolutionary War?
It was possible to remain neutral, particularly if you were not in the front lines of the fight. And in my research, I was struck to discover diaries and letters by just ordinary folks, farmers in New Hampshire and so on, who had sympathies that led them to the Loyalist side and certainly found themselves caught up in local tensions as members of their community took different positions, but who were nevertheless able to kind of lie low and wait it out. And so it was possible for some people to do that. That said, I think the violence of the war and the degree to which this really was a war that spread into all kinds of parts of this country really forced people caught up in that violence to take sides, often in situations where they really would have preferred not to have to get involved in this at all.
Tell us about Thomas Brown.
Thomas Brown was a Yorkshireman from the northern part of England who emigrated to the colony of Georgia in 1774. He was one of thousands and thousands of residents of the colonies on the eve of the Revolution who had actually only recently come from England. Something like 15% of the population at that time had only recently arrived. He came because of all the things that have long attracted people to America, the idea of opportunities. He brought with him a number of indentured laborers whom he had recruited in England to come and farm a vast amount of land that he had been able to acquire on the cheap in Georgia. So Thomas Brown came to America expecting to have a long and flourishing future on this side of the Atlantic. What he found instead, however, was that within a year or 18 months of his arrival, there was a war in the offing. And although he wanted to go on and farm his land and get rich in America, he found himself caught up in the violence when a gang of armed men basically came to his plantation demanding that he side with the Patriot cause as it was emerging. And he found himself unwilling to do this, partly because his land was something that he owed in part to the colonial legislature. And in the course of this conflict, Brown ended up being attacked by this gang of men, being terribly beaten up, abused, practically tarred and feathered, practically scalped, and practically killed. And it was the violence of this terrible trauma which miraculously he survived.
Yeah, when you describe it in the book, and we won't do that here in case people are still eating lunch, but it is hard to believe that he made it out alive.
Yeah. Yeah, so he made it out alive, and then the memory of this, or the physical reality of this horrible thing that happened to him, led him to become a much more active and engaged loyalist than he had ever anticipated he might. And so he became a loyalist commander, raising troops on his own behalf and fighting against the Patriots in Georgia.
Was that attack on Brown an aberration, or was this something that was happening all over the colonies?
This kind of violence did happen all over the colonies. Now, the famous example of anti-loyalist violence that we all know about is tarring and feathering. Mm-hmm. That didn't happen a whole lot, although there were a few dozen cases at the beginning of the war. But violence itself, as I think I mentioned earlier, is a feature of the war that we tend to kind of downplay, I think, in our memory of this struggle. We focus more on the ideals and less on the ordeals. And the kind of violence that affected Brown affected lots of other people, families who were chased out of their houses, land that was crops that were burned, cattle and pigs that were poisoned in people's fields. So there really was this kind of popular violence of against potential loyalists.
Can you talk for just a minute about tarring and feathering? That expression is used so often today that it almost, we've reduced it to sounding like a fraternity prank or something. But this was a really, it was a huge violation. It was very painful.
Yeah, I mean, tarring and feathering was far from a fraternity prank. Think about it. It involves having hot pitch poured on your skin. I realize people may be eating lunch, but it involves this hot pitch being poured on your skin. The feathers are applied to that. You're basically burned by the stuff stuck on you, and then you can't get it off without taking your skin off too. So it was really a very, very savage form of popular justice.
How did the loyalists who wanted to fight for the crown mix with the imperial soldiers who came from overseas?
Some loyalists joined British regiments outright. They just signed up in the British Army. Many more loyalists ended up forming regiments of their own that were manned largely by colonial Americans, but these acted sort of in concert with British troops. But the number one way in which loyalists and the British interacted during the war was that the British during the war held on to a variety of cities in the future United States as strongholds. These included New York, Charleston, and Savannah. And during the war, thousands and thousands of loyalist refugees came into these cities from surrounding areas feeling persecuted, threatened, etc., and came and lived inside these British-held cities where they basically lived under martial law in British, militarily occupied cities. And they had to sort of deal with the difficulties of living under martial law even while they were dependent on the British for a kind of protection.
Were the loyalists who fought for the crown explicitly promised rewards during the war itself, or was that something that came after?
They were not. They hoped very much, of course, that they would never be in a position of losing the war. So the loss of the war in and of itself was a great shock to many loyalists, and so it should have been, because here you saw the British Empire, one of the biggest military powers in the world, being defeated by what looked to many like a bunch of provincial upstarts. But as loyalists took on board the reality of loss and the reality that much of the property that they had lost personally during the war wasn't necessarily going to come back to them, they began to turn to Britain in hopes of some sort of compensation. And in the final peace treaty that ended the war, loyalists were not officially granted any sort of compensation by the United States, but they turned their attention instead to the British government to try to get something from them.
Maya Jazanoff is my guest. She's Associate Professor of History at Harvard University and author of the new book, Liberty's Exiles, American Loyalists in the Revolutionary World. You can join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, offering an information session March 15th for its CFP certificate program in Dallas, starting in April. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Associate Professor of History at Harvard, Maya Jazanoff. Her new book is called Liberty's Exiles, American Loyalists in the Revolutionary World. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Maya, we'll fast forward a little bit here at the expense of glossing over years of history. Everybody knows how the war turned out. So in 1783, loyalists are left with what I imagine in many cases was an agonizing decision about whether to stay or whether to go, and then where to go.
Absolutely. You know, at the end of the war, there were something like 100,000 people living in the British-held strongholds of New York, Charleston, and Savannah. And these people faced a very difficult choice. You know, they had often fled their homes during the war and didn't really know what type of conditions they would find if they tried to return home. They had, in many cases, experienced violence at first or second hand. And so the prospects of staying in the United States were very uncertain to them. They didn't really know what would happen to their life or their liberty or their pursuit of happiness. On the other hand, there they were in these British-held cities with a bunch of British ships sitting in the harbors promising to take them away for free to different British domains. And so many loyalists caught in this bind had to decide, you know, were they going to risk it and try to stay on in a war-torn environment, or were they going to follow the British and get on a ship destined for a completely unknown location?
And it must have been incredibly hard to organize those massive evacuations. There was a guy named Guy Carleton, who was in charge of a lot of these.
Yeah, Guy Carleton was the commander-in-chief of the British Army at the very end of the war. He was the counterpart to George Washington. Mm-hmm. And in researching him, he really sort of turned into a bit of a hero for me to just sort of see what he had to contend with. He came into this position after the war had, for all practical purposes, been lost. And his mandate was to get the British forces and as many loyalist civilians as wanted to go out of the colonies in safety. And it was an incredible organizational challenge. You know, he had too few ships. He had, again, up to something like 100,000 personnel to evacuate from three or four different cities up and down the eastern seaboard. He had all of the kind of material and, you know, the weapons and the animals and everything that the British Army had used during the war to dispense with. And he had to figure out how best to prepare for these great loyalist refugee evacuations and send them away with as many provisions as he possibly could. So it was an incredible organizational and logistical challenge, and it's a whole part of the history of the Revolution that actually gets kind of skated over in the history books.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones to Theodore in Dallas. Hi, Theodore.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yes, I just first wanted to thank you for calling attention to this important topic, which is a special interest of mine. I may live in 2011, but I'm still very much sympathetic to the loyalist point of view as one who's always loved the British monarchy. And I guess my question is, why do you think this point of view has been so ignored over the years? Because I get the idea that most Americans have the impression that the colonists almost unanimously rose up against British rule.
Thanks for your call, Theodore. And that also points out the fact that there were a significant number of loyalists who remained in what is now the United States.
There were, yeah. The majority of loyalists did remain in the future United States, which helps to give some explanation, I think, for the question that Theodore asks. You know, look, winners write the history, and so it's not particularly surprising that the patriot perspective should have been the one that prevailed in our accounts of our revolutionary past. But I think there's more to it. I think that we are the United States, and we like to emphasize all of the kinds of things that we have in common with one another. And so the idea that we were actually born out of a moment of great division is something that sits somewhat uncomfortably against this desire, very real desire, and in many ways very good desire, to find unity amongst ourselves. And the fact that so many loyalists actually did remain in the United States and become, one way or another, integrated into the new nation, I think contributes to this kind of perspective that has by contrast, of course, left out that very important number who didn't find a place and who did end up leaving.
So, Maya, it's easy to think about those who had recently immigrated to the United States having not as much problem sort of picking up and starting over somewhere else. It didn't work out here. Maybe you go to Canada, to Australia, to India. But there were loyalists who had been born on New World soil who had to find a new life for themselves in a place they'd never been to before.
Absolutely. You know, loyalists were every bit as American, quote unquote, as patriots. And, you know, some of them were Mayflower descendants and knew nothing else. And they found themselves, you know, uprooted from their homes and their friends and sometimes their family members and sent off to these, you know, in many cases, totally unfamiliar places. Even Britain itself, which was a destination for several thousand loyalist refugees, was often a very unfamiliar location. For all that they had been raised to think of Britain as home, as many Americans were at that time, it was unfamiliar to them. Very few had ever been there. And they found themselves in a completely unfamiliar sort of environment. And so much the more so for some of the loyalists who ended up in places like Jamaica, a tropical island rather different from any part of the United States, or for that matter, the Canadian wilderness, you know, freezing in Nova Scotia winters.
And that was the destination for a significant community of formerly enslaved African Americans.
Yeah. Within the population of loyalists who left the U.S., one of the most intriguing is this very large group of former slaves who had responded to those British promises of freedom during the Revolution, had run away from their patriot owners, joined the British, and earned freedom and been evacuated from the future United States by the British. Several thousand of them ended up in Nova Scotia, where they founded for a time what was the largest, one of the largest free black communities on this side of the Atlantic. And for them, this wasn't just a new environment that they were contending with, it was also just a whole new way of life. They were free. Mm-hmm. And previously, that was a condition they had probably never dreamed they would arrive at.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go next to David in Dallas. Hi, David.
Hi. This is so interesting. We are actually going to be talking about Liberty's Exiles in a class I'm taking at UTD this semester. Huh. And so we haven't read the book yet, but I'm really excited now that I get to hear the author. In fact, last week we read Dr. Pybus's book. I think that you had just mentioned the black population, the slave population that had fought as loyalists and went up to Nova Scotia. So we just discussed that book last week. So it was really interesting. My question is, were there any, in your research, were there any Anglican or, I guess, a part of the established church ministers who were really preaching about staying loyal to the British crown because of their, you know, their Christian teachings or whatever?
Thanks for your call.
Yeah.
Thanks, David. And since you mentioned it, let me put in a plug here, by the way, for a terrific book about the black loyalists, which David referred to. It's called Epic Journeys of Freedom, and it's a wonderful study of these former slaves. In answer to your question, there were a number of Anglican ministers who found themselves in a real bind at the time of the Revolution, not just because of their Christian beliefs, but also because as Anglican ministers, they belonged to a church whose head was the king. And so the idea of renouncing the king was sort of a double problem for them. On the one hand, a form of blasphemy almost, and on the other, a real sort of renunciation of the authority that they kind of owed their whole livelihood to. So there is some strong kind of Anglican loyalism going on among a number of preachers in the colonies. I haven't been able to look so much into the specific theological grounds, but there are certainly some clergymen such as Charles Inglis, who was in New York City, who wrote a number of very, very educated, very intelligent tracts on the subject of loyalty using their faith to bolster that. So I think it all just points again to the idea that, you know, this division between loyalists and patriots could be a very deep one, and there were many, many compelling reasons for people to remain loyal to the crown.
How did a group of black loyalists go from Canada to Sierra Leone? First of all, it sounds like an awful, awful trip.
Yes, it's an amazing voyage, one of many amazing voyages that Loyalists undertook at this time. The Black Loyalists who ended up in Nova Scotia had their freedom, and that was, as I mentioned, a wonderful thing that few of them had ever imagined they would experience. At the same time, they had their freedom in a place that was tricky to make a living in. It was very cold. They had very poor, sort of meager land grants to try to scratch out crops from, and partly because they had never had the experience of working for wages and being free, many of them found themselves in these conditions of employment to white employers that uncannily and uncomfortably resembled their previous conditions of enslavement, sort of indentured, getting very low wages, having very little say about what to do. So they were in a bad situation. And as the years went on, leaders in this Black Loyalist community began to protest against the bad conditions in which they and their fellows were living. And this set of complaints dovetailed very conveniently and very interestingly with a group of abolitionists in Britain who were advocating for an end to the slave trade and who had in mind the idea of creating a colony for free black people to live in West Africa, where they could show that free blacks could have a profitable colony, profitable life, and would thereby sort of undercut the justification for the slave trade. So these two agendas really meshed in a timely manner, with the result that the Black Loyalists from Canada ended up becoming the pioneer colonists for the abolitionist experiment that is today Freetown in Sierra Leone.
Did the British rule Canada with a lighter touch based on what happened in the 13 American colonies?
It's an interesting question how the British responded to the American Revolution, because what they decided had happened in the colonies was not that the colonists had been given too little liberty. In fact, they decided in many ways that the colonists had been given too much. They had been allowed to articulate their grievances a little too freely for some British tastes. And so one of the responses among British imperial legislators after the war was, in fact, to clamp down a little bit and to be a bit more centralized, a bit more authoritarian, a bit more directly tied to the king. That said, they did realize a couple of important things. They realized that colonists in North America liked to have a lot of land, they liked to have it cheaply, and they also did not like to pay taxes. And so one of the consequences in Canada after the American Revolution is that, in fact, the taxes that British subjects were paying in Canada were very, very light, especially as compared with the citizens of the United States.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Carrollton and speak with Carla. Hi, Carla.
Hi. I just think this is absolutely fascinating. I, for one, I'm a perfect example. I had no idea of the Loyalist side of things. And I'm wondering how long did your research take and where, you know, what all resources did you look into and to find all this knowledge and where this was all hidden?
Thanks for your call. Sounds like a tantalizing project.
Yeah, it really was. You know, I myself was startled to discover this when I first did, because I, of course, had learned American history in school and learned the narrative that most of us still learn. So for me, it was really amazing to discover that not only was there this whole Loyalist side to the revolution that had barely been explored, but that there were so many who left the U.S. and had this amazing international history. So as I set about doing this project, I thought a bit about why it hadn't been done before. And one of the things I realized is that, you know, when sources are scattered around the world, it makes it a little harder to do this kind of project. That said, there are some wonderful resources that make this kind of thing easier today. Those include the Internet. And one of the things that really made this project feasible for me was the ability to see what kinds of sources there are in archives around the world, to access digitized versions of historic newspapers and that sort of thing from my own living room. I also, though, made a point of traveling to all of the places that the Loyalists themselves ended up journeying to. So my research over the last 4 or 5 years has taken me to Jamaica, to Canada, and even to Freetown in Sierra Leone.
What kinds of records did Guy Carleton and his colleagues keep with regard to who got on which ship and arrived where?
The records kept by the British state are really quite good. They had a lot of correspondence amongst themselves about how to dispose of different types of property, where the ships would go, when. It's a bookkeeping empire, the British Empire. But perhaps the most remarkable document that is in the papers of Guy Carleton and his crew is a register that lists the names of these black loyalists, the freed slaves. It's called the Book of Negroes, and it was kept at the docks in New York City in 1783 as the ships were sailing out with the refugees on board. And it was a register in which the names of the former slaves were listed, their age, their former owners, and sometimes just a tiny bit of a description, like a fine fellow or a stout wench. And this register was intended to be kept by the British so that when American slave owners came to complain about the fact that their slaves had run away, the British could show them this register and say, look, we've documented all of this. Their freedom has been guaranteed, and, you know, this is where they've gone.
I'm also curious about, were they promised, when they went to these different places where the British Empire was looking to expand, were they automatically promised land if they got on a British ship and went somewhere else?
They were, more or less, yes. Land was offered to them in Canada and in the Bahamas in particular. And so when they made the decision to go, by and large, they knew that they were going to get some land. This also happened for the settlers who moved to Sierra Leone, who were recruited to go there partly with promises of land grants. And in fact, there's an amazing printed document that was put together by the people behind the Sierra Leone scheme that was circulated among the black loyalists in Nova Scotia that very clearly outlined all of the terms on which they would be able to go. So the land grants were a known part of the package, and it's one of the pull factors, I think, that helps explain why so many refugees ended up leaving.
Maya Jazanoff is my guest. She's Associate Professor of History at Harvard University and author of the new book, Liberty's Exiles, American Loyalists in the Revolutionary World. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, offering an information session March 15th for its CFP certificate program in Dallas, starting in April. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Associate Professor of History at Harvard, Maya Jazanoff. Her new book is called Liberty's Exiles, American Loyalists in the Revolutionary World. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. Maya, we haven't even talked yet about Florida. Kirby in Irving asks a question. Is it true almost all of Florida remained loyal to Britain during the Revolution and that some signers of the Declaration of Independence were imprisoned there?
I'm not sure about the second part of the question, but to the first part, Florida was pretty sparsely populated by whites, at least at that time. It was divided into two parts, East Florida and West Florida. East Florida had the majority of residents. During the war, thousands of loyalists from the southern colonies, the Carolinas, Georgia, ended up moving to East Florida because it was relatively free of fighting. And at the end of the war, this was another of the places where loyalists hoped that they might be able to get land and restart their lives. So they were devastated to find out that in the peace treaty ending the war, Florida was actually handed over to Spain by Britain. And so these about 11, 12,000 refugees who had moved there during the war were shocked, and the immediate aftermath of the war, were shocked to find out that they would have to move again and become refugees for a second time.
It must have been particularly hard for Native Americans who had sided with the British Empire to certainly pick up and leave the continent. Can you talk about the different fates of tribes based on what they decided to do after the war?
There were a number of Native American nations, which had been allied with Britain in previous wars with France and so on. And these included most prominently the Mohawks of upstate New York, who, when the American Revolution broke out, decided again to side with the British, with whom they had longstanding relations. And upstate New York was one of various places in the future U.S. that was really sort of ravaged by fighting on the frontiers with a very heavy Native American component. And so at the end of the war, they too, like so many white loyalists, like many black loyalists, found themselves sort of facing this question of what to do after defeat. And the Mohawks in particular ended up getting land grants themselves in Canada and moving west through New York State and settling around Niagara, today's Niagara, where they tried to kind of establish a new foothold for their community. But other Native American nations ended up basically being on the losing side and having little to show for it. And the future history for nations like the Creek Indians became a very, very tragic example of how the losers in the American Revolution ended up paying a very heavy price.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. This time we will speak with Derek in Euless. Hi, Derek.
Yes, hi. How are you doing?
Great, thanks. Mm-hmm. Go right ahead, please. Derek, do you have a question for us?
Yes, I was just going to ask... I heard about Sierra Leone, about the loyalists that left this great land and went back to Africa after after slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to know exactly the information and the research and where I could at least go, where I could get the information from about Sierra Leone, because I'm one of the byproducts of the slavery that happened in America that got the people back to Africa.
So your ancestors left the United States and went to Sierra Leone.
Yes.
That's fascinating. Maya, can you give them any good ideas?
Yeah, that's a terrific thing to hear about. The settling of Freetown and Sierra Leone was really what I call the first Back to Africa movement in modern history. It happened a generation before the settlement of Liberia, something that Americans had a heavier hand in and tend to know a little bit more about. But the story of Sierra Leone is really where this kind of Back to Africa instinct begins. In addition to quite a bit on this subject in my own book, I would again refer the caller to the book Epic Journeys of Freedom that a previous caller had mentioned by Cassandra Pybus. And I would also say that there's a bit of renewed interest among some of the descendants of this community in America today. There's a musician, in fact, based in the Washington, D.C. area who recorded an album a few years ago called Black Loyalist that was trying to build on this tradition and reintroduce awareness of it among the black community, both here and in Sierra Leone itself.
What role did some black loyalists in Sierra Leone have in perpetuating the slave trade from Africa to the United States?
The slave trade from Africa to across the Atlantic was something that had, of course, a very, very heavy European and white involvement to it, but also depended a lot on indigenous African slave traders. And coming out of West Africa, there was a lot of black African participation in the slave trade as well. In the case of Sierra Leone in particular, one of the many ironies to the founding of Freetown was that it was sited just a very short distance from one of the largest British slave trading posts in West Africa. And the uneasy juxtaposition of this settlement dedicated to freedom right next to a very significant slave trading post created a bunch of tensions in the area. And the local ruler of the area around Freetown himself was involved in the slave traffic and was friendly with some of the slave traders in the region. So there were a lot of competing interests in this area. And in that sense, it's quite a miracle that a project like Freetown actually got off the ground and grew and survived.
Did the British consider former loyalists to be better suited to move into different colonial areas and try to establish a British foothold than other British subjects?
I think they did, because the Loyalists from America were people whose loyalty had already been confirmed.
Mm-hmm.
They had shown that they were willing to stand up for these values, and so they were seen as a useful population. They were also useful in another way, though, and that was that the Loyalist refugees were dispossessed, and the British had found that it was rather difficult to encourage people to settle in some of the more remote parts of Nova Scotia. It was rather difficult to get people to settle in the fairly sandy, hard-to-cultivate islands of the Bahamas, and it would be especially difficult to encourage anybody to travel halfway around the world and settle in a place as far away as Australia. So the fact that the Loyalists were not only loyal, self-evidently, and thus very good subjects for an empire to have, but also were dispossessed and needed to go places, meant that the British could really use them to advance settlement schemes in parts of the empire that they had more trouble populating.
You tell us the story of Elizabeth Johnston and her family, and she, it seems like for the rest of her life almost, was on the move.
One of the things that I was struck by in working on this book is the degree to which people who are dislocated once in their lives seemed, at least in many of the cases I looked at, to have trouble finding a home again. And many of the Loyalist refugees who left the colonies ended up moving more than once. And the case of Elizabeth Johnston was an exceptionally vivid example of this. She was a teenager when she got married during the war to a Loyalist soldier and spent the early years of her married life starting a family while being a refugee, moving from one place to another as British forces were evacuating. And her family went on to struggle in a number of locations to try to kind of find a base and find a fortune for themselves again. And this was a quest that took them from Florida to Scotland, where her husband was a medical student, then to Jamaica, a yet different environment, where they contended with terrible pressures of climate and even loneliness. There were very, very few white women living in Jamaica at that time. And then ultimately this quest took her to Nova Scotia, the place where so many Loyalist refugees had settled, but that she only arrived in herself some 20, 30 years after her peregrinations began.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Amanda in Fort Worth. Hi, Amanda.
Hello. My question is, has your research informed the way you view the kind of modern Tea Party movement, the political movement? Maybe you found that history is not so black and white, and I'll take my comments off the air.
Thanks for your call. Maya, you want to comment on that?
Sure. So history is not black and white. I think my research in this book certainly confirmed that impression that I had anyway as a historian. But, you know, I think that what it's made me realize is that the American Revolution is our founding event, and we turn to it as a touchstone for so many things about who we are today. And so what I felt doing this book was that, given how central this founding moment is for us as Americans today, it's that much more important that we get a full picture of what it was really about. And so I felt that we should know the different sides, we should know the different stakes, we should know what unfolded in our founding moments, given how important those continue to be to us today.
I think we have time for one more phone call. We'll go to Franklin in Fort Worth. Hi, Franklin.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I noted that on a recent trip to Nova Scotia, the Loyalists, or descendants of Loyalists, and the apparent fraternal organizations and lodges, if you will, that they've formed there, and the pride that they apparently take in their ancestry as being Loyalists from the American Revolution, reminded me of the Australians who are descendants of folks that were what the English call transported down there, which was a criminal sentence. And now they take no small amount of pride in their ancestors who founded a very desolate country. The ironic part of that being that both of those are products of the English monarch. And I wondered if the doctor treated particularly the Nova Scotia aspect of it in her book. I have not read that book, but I'm going to. I became intrigued with loyalists as far back as Oliver Wiswell that I'm sure she's heard of.
Well, Franklin, thanks for your call. Nova Scotia and Australia are both in the book. Did you want to say anything else about them, Maya?
Yeah, thanks for the comments. I think it's interesting to go to Canada and see the other side of the American Revolution there, because it's like stepping through a looking glass. You know, on this side we have so much heritage interest devoted to our founding fathers, and in Canada they do as well. It's just that their founding fathers, in some sense, were on the other side. And so there is quite an active kind of historical tradition in Canada, in eastern Canada, Nova Scotia in particular, that is devoted to this loyalist heritage. And I guess drawing Australia into the picture, what it calls attention to is that every nation, in a way, looks back to its origin moments or creates myths of its origins that continue to be very important and influential to how they see themselves in the present. And as a historian, it's very interesting to think about the ways in which those ideas of origins have changed over time and can be used over time. And I think our own revolutionary tradition is no exception.
I wonder if you think part of the reason that we've lost that the loyalist element from our mythology that we've created around our own founding, because those who did stay here who were loyalists probably didn't go around boasting about it after the war was over.
That's right. And again, it comes back to this question of unity, that so many loyalists did stay and were reintegrated. In fact, the differences between loyalist and patriot ended up mapping on to the differences between political parties in the new republic. That, you know, this wasn't a kind of ongoing source of division, and it was in particular a kind of divide that people had a great investment in trying to paper over. That said, I think that it's important to remember that we did have a civil war a couple of generations later, and that for people at the time, there was a lot of thinking back to the American Revolution in the context of the U.S. Civil War. And in fact, the first historian in America who worked at length on the Loyalists actually published a big book, which had a second edition coming out in the U.S. Civil War, in which he said he hoped that his investigations of the Loyalists, the other side in our first Civil War, as he put it, would give us a better understanding, better sympathy for one another coming out of the Civil War of the 1860s.
We have just a few seconds here, but I'm curious, are the documents that you had to use in this research, are they on microfilm now? Are they all digitized, or did you actually have to go through with the white gloves on and page through old documents?
Well, alas for me, a lot of them are on microfilm, and I say alas because it's very difficult on the eyes to read microfilm documents. So for me, it's actually a great pleasure to go through the actual papers, and there's something really magical about handling those kinds of documents, you know, particularly when you're in a place like Sierra Leone.
Well,
and you see the documents.
We certainly
appreciate it's a wonderful
thing. The results of that. The book is called Liberty's Exiles, American Loyalists in the Revolutionary World by Maya Jazanoff. Maya, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.